nub of it. If we think of Der Freischütz in the sweep of music history, the probably laziest cliche that I was almost certainly guilty of when I in the Proms podcast that some of you may have the opportunity to have heard, is that it's a very important work of German opera and is in some way a predecessor or something that inspired Berlioz, Wagner particularly, and sort of cemented ideas of the supernatural, a certain kind of what would become a sort of obsession with later 19th century German opera. But John Elliott, I think what you'd like to tell me and probably the world is that that's completely wrong, and that in fact, Der Freischütz has at least one leg, if not two, in French opera.
It's not completely wrong, because it did have a huge influence on German opera, and that was certainly Weber's intention. He was trying to invent a school of German opera.
Right.
The problem is he had no models other than the failure of Fidelio as it was in his day, and of course Magic Flute and Entführung. But his aim was to create a new school of German opera, he and Louis Spohr. But interestingly, his models for it were nearly all French. And in the years when Weber was running the Dresden Opera, of the 12 operas that he revived, I think 10 of them were actually French operas. If you count Cherubini as a French composer, which I suppose you should do, because he lived in France most of his time.
Lived in France.
You may say, well, what's the point? Is that important? It's only important in the sense that the French revolutionary composers, Méhul particularly, Grétry, Dallairac, and Cherubini, were building on Baroque opera, the Baroque opera of Rameau, and to some extent of Lully and Charpentier in the previous century, in the way that they were combining all sorts of different elements. They were combining dance, they were combining melody, orchestral, evocative music to link scenes, divertissement, wonderful choruses, and what the French prized above all, which is le merveilleux, the magical, which is stage effects, machinery, and that's what Weber was particularly keen to do, and he provided wonderful opportunities for it in Le Freischütz. But it's interesting that his opera, leave out the French story of what happened in Paris with Berlioz, but in Germany, it became subsumed into this gargantuan machine that was Richard Wagner, and that any music that preceded Wagner had to be somehow have been pre-composed by Wagner in some bizarre kind of way. And the sad, that's fine. It's great to have a strong personality, but what's really sad is that if you go to a German opera house today, you will still see mostly, when Freischütz is done, it's done as a proto-Wagnerian piece.
Yeah, but
You're going to have big breastplated Valkyries and
huntsmen
in Lederhosen and, a lot of and all that sort of stuff. It's questionable whether that really has anything to do with the piece at all.
Right, thank you very much. Very good. Do you want to just perform that? But surely, there was a folk-like element to what Weber is doing. I mean, he does borrow from German folk tunes.
Oh, there undoubtedly.
Is German folk storytelling in
absolutely.
There. I mean, that's absolutely there. You can't, for all your Francophilia, you can't deny that.
Not at all. I'm not trying to. What I'm objecting to is the way of performing the opera as though it is a proto-Wagnerian
week. What you've referred to on videos, I know he's used these words, the Lederhosen and Valkyrie approach to Der Freischütz. You've also called it a very dry singspiel in its original version, which suggests that you regard not just that, not in, in other words, it suggests that what you think of this Berlioz version of Freischütz isn't simply that it's that we hear a Berliozan gloss on the piece, but rather you think, I wonder if you think, that this is really what the piece ought to have been all along.
No,
this
I don't
version.
Think that. I think that it stands up beautifully as a Singspiel, but Singspiels are a big compromise, aren't they? I mean, because of the two-paced nature of it. And I think that Berlioz deliberately or by chance, by serendipity, actually did Weber something of a favour in through composing it. And it's for you to judge tonight, to see what you think. I mean, if it works as a continuous music drama. It certainly works on the stage that way. And I think it's good in European music, the culture that we prize so much, to see that there are different channels of influence that that can throw a different perspective on, you know, iconic pieces.
So does this become a French opera? I mean, does even something like hearing the translation in French, does it become a French opera effectively tonight?
In a sense, I think the fact that we sing it in French gives it a totally different flavour. I mean, the difference between Der Jagd, the hunt, and La Chasse is already quite big. And there's something about the French language and the sensuality of the French language which does colour it. But, you know, I think we should stop maybe making too much of a thing about whether it's French or German. The fact is that it's the collision of two wonderful composers here, who are just Promethean in their ambitions for music. I mean, if you had to choose a single decade of the 19th century, I reckon the 1820s would probably be it, when so much is going on. There's turmoil. I mean, the last years of Beethoven, the last years of Schubert, the beginnings of Berlioz, the end of Weber, the beginnings of Mendelssohn. So much is going on, and the essence of it really is the taking of literary models and literary culture and saying, by musicians, and saying, we can do this as well. We can encapsulate in music the poetry of Byron or of Goethe, of Schiller. We can make dramas, a drama of equivalent power. And this goes for Rossini, of course. I mean, it goes for anybody who collided with Schiller. It's an incredibly intoxicating time. And people had passionate views about the way music was going and what new language was erupting and available to musicians. The center of it all is the use of the orchestra, because the orchestra, instead of being, even in the hands of a genius like Mozart, being a wonderful part of the whole web of characterization of the dramatis personae, it still is an orchestra that's accompanying. By the time you get to even Beethoven in the Fidelio, and by the time you get to Le Freischütz, and of course when you get to Benvenuto Cellini in Le Trojans, Les Troyens, you've got the orchestra being really the motor, the engine room of the drama, and that's what's so exciting.
And that's really what Berlioz heard in Weber for the first time.
Because I think that's what he heard.
Gluck and Spontini don't do that, to be fair to them, do they?
So this
is the sort of the psychology of the orchestra is expanding, the sense of everything being up for grabs, the sense of making those new sounds. And of course, what you're doing tonight with the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique is, well, as you do so often in your performances, or all the time with the performances with that orchestra, you know, reclaim the sense of that newness, how it would have sounded. The excitement of the combinations of instruments that Berlioz and Weber are creating. So, I mean, how does your version of Le Freischütz sound different to the sort of Germanic ones we may have heard on disc?
Well, the use of period instruments is always a tricky thing, because it's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And when it becomes an end in itself, the chances are that it's not going to work. If it's a means towards approaching a little bit closer to the sound world that, as envisaged by two such interesting and original composers as Weber and Berlioz, then it's worth it, I think, because it, especially in the perspective of what I've just been referring to, of the orchestra taking, moving it towards into the foreground, it creates a whole new range of dynamics and of colours, orchestral colours, instrumental colours, which contribute enormously to the experience of the listener. And the absolute classic case of this in this opera is the scene of the Wolf's Glen
at the end of Act Two,
which is just a prodigious piece of music drama. I mean, the orchestras play non-stop for about 12 minutes, and it's a monologue, or, well, it becomes a duo some of the time between Gaspar, who's the baddie, and Max, who's the wronged hero. And it takes place in the forest, and there is this crucible where the bullets, the magic bullets, are being cast and forged. And you feel, I mean, picking up on your remark earlier, Tom, about the German folklore, it's absolutely German folklore, this. It's all to do with the concept of the forest and how important the forest is in German the German psychology, from 16th century onwards. I mean, I don't know whether any of you know that wonderful book that Simon Sharma wrote called Landscape and Memory, where he explores the psychological and metaphysical and iconic importance of the forest in the German psychology, both as a place of refuge and as also as a place to find your roots, your Ur-Ur-Wald and your Ur-Ur-Roots, as it were. And of course, in the 30 Years' War, it was a place to rush off and hide from marauding armies, but also and a place to forage, to find food where you wouldn't find it in the open landscape. And it's just such a hugely important place. It's where good and evil coexist. It's where it's very spooky, but it's also full of energy. And this Wolf's Glen scene is a real exploration of the preoccupations of German thinkers and religious leaders from Martin Luther forwards.
But it's also, in this case, an absolute virtuoso case of what you could do with an orchestra. And also, again, thinking Weber wrote that in 1821, you know, Beethoven still had 6 years to live. I mean, Nobody else was using the orchestra like that at that time, were they? I mean, this is absolutely the first time that the orchestra had been used this extremely, ever.
And pieces like The Damnation of Faust, of Berlioz, would have been inconceivable without it. Mm-hmm. The Ride to the Abyss. And it's interesting that Berlioz started to write his 8 scenes from Faust, from Goethe's Faust, pretty well after he'd first heard Freischütz for the first time.
What then do you think, is it possible to sum up what Weber's influence on Berlioz was, you know, after his death, when Berlioz is writing all the operas and the symphonies and quasi-symphonies that he would go on to do? Do you think you hear the Weber's influence right the way through the rest of Berlioz's life?
I think really what it amounts to is that both of them started off as talented, genial amateurs, because Berlioz was largely self-taught, was never intended by his parents to be a musician, had to fight his way through to become a musician, as he was meant to go and become a doctor, and then fought his way to get lessons from Le Sueur. And Weber himself was not the most talented, was not the most richly endowed a musician, if you compare him, say, to Mendelssohn, who was just prodigiously gifted from the word go. And yet both of them, through the power of their imagination, I think it's mostly imaginative force and power, found common ground between them and saw the orchestra as the way to be the pigment on their canvas. I think that's the key to it. And maybe there's something else too. There's the melodic gift. There's something so touching about Weber's use of an individual instrument. Often it's in this opera, it's often the clarinet, and often very in a low tessitura, which is very spooky. But when the clarinet is being lyrical, as in, for instance, Max's first act aria, he proposes a melody that doesn't always sit comfortably with the voice and with the words, but again, he's suggesting that the instrument can be just as poetic as the singer, and I think that's something that Berlioz picked up on.
So, Le Freischütz, a homage, but also a revelation. John Elliott Gardner, thank you very much.
Tom Service talking to John Elliott Gardner earlier this evening down at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Helen Garrison. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall on this penultimate night of the 2011 season, live on Radio 3. I'm Martin Handley. We've reached Act 3 in the first ever Proms performance of Weber's opera Der Freischütz, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. When the Paris Opera decided to present this piece for the first time at their opera house, there were two main problems. The piece had absolutely no ballet, unheard of in any work presented there, as was any piece which included spoken dialogue. Berlioz had heard of what the opera proposed and wrote, "There is talk these days of pulling Der Freischütz to pieces, of seasoning it according to Parisian recipes. Fortunately, these rumours seem to have stopped." Well, he was wrong, and when he was asked to provide recitatives and ballet, replied that though he thought it a bad idea to get what he regarded as Weber's work performed and avoid somebody less devoted to his cause being asked to do it, he would accept. As far as the ballet was concerned, Berlioz's brainwave was simply to orchestrate Weber's own piano piece, Invitation to the Dance. Berlioz wrote to his sister Adele, "I am Weber's shield, and when I stage the rehearsals, I hope to put a bit of pep into these sluggardly rascals of singers." Well, earlier I talked to two of tonight's rascals, Guidon Sachs and Andrew Kennedy, and asked whether Freischütz needed singing in a different way in French.
It's much harder to sing in French, I have to say. And of course, when you sing the original language, it just all fits in your mouth like a peach melba. It's marvellous. I find French hugely challenging, and I was a bit overawed by it in the beginning and shed a few tears, but I got there eventually.
Andrew, do you think this piece has a relationship with French opera? I mean, just listening to a bit of it now, suddenly you do hear Faust or whatever.
Yeah, and certainly the French language changes it enormously. And I know that John Elliott wanted to cast it in a very specific way. He wanted to get away from the larger Heldon roles, which
well,
is
exactly.
why...
Max is often a Heldon tenor,
exactly. I mean, it's incredibly low. It's a very mid-range part. Yeah. It's a challenge.
Guidon, you've done it in a German original, so with the spoken dialogue.
Yeah.
How for you do the recitatives work? Do they work? Does it help? Does it make it more fluid?
I have to say, I find them kind of refreshing and new and different. I think Berlioz almost sort of cherry-picked the most interesting stuff. And I'm fascinated by what he's done with it. And in the beginning, I felt that it didn't naturally always flow very organically from recit into aria or ensemble. But now it feels like it's the most normal thing in the world. And it's terrific to do. It's lots of fun.
Guidon Sachs and Andrew Kennedy. Well, Act 3 of Der Freischütz begins with Agathe in her room, putting her trust in God as she gets ready for her big day. A letter appears and asks her whether she slept well. "No," she replies, "I had a nightmare. I was changed into a white dove and was shot. As I fell, I became myself again, with a black eagle at my feet covered with blood." Annette tries to interpret the dream in a positive way, but Agathe won't buy it, so Annette, as always, tries to cheer her up by telling her the tale of her great aunt, who's terrified by the clanking chains and fiery eyes she sees coming towards her. But when she wakes, it's just Nero, the watchdog. Bridesmaids come in to sing a folk song, bringing with them the box holding the bridal crown. And when Annette opens it, she finds instead a funeral wreath. Hastily, she weaves a new crown from the white roses Agathe was given by the hermit. As the huntsmen wait for the shooting competition to begin, they sing of the pleasures of the hunt before we hear that Parisian ballet interpolation, Berlioz's orchestration of Weber's Invitation to the Dance. Prince Ottokar, sung by the baritone Robert Davis, reminds the huntsmen why they're gathered. He tells Kuno Max will be a worthy son-in-law and wonders why the bride is late. "Nerves," suggests Kuno, and the prince agrees to start the competition without her. The prince tells Max to shoot a white dove in a tree. Agathe appears from behind the tree to tell Max she is the dove. But he fires and Agathe falls to the ground, as does Gaspar. Agathe slowly revives, and Gaspar realizes what's happened. Agatha's protected by the white roses from the hermit. He curses the hermit and Zamiel himself as he comes to claim him. Max has to confess to Prince Ottokar that he made a pact with the devil, and the prince banishes him forever. Agathe, Max, and Kuno are horror-struck, but the prince won't listen. He's interrupted by an old man, the hermit, sung by the bass Luc Bertin Hugo, who tells the prince his punishment is unjust for a man whose heart has remained true and who is full of remorse. Ottokar commutes the banishment to 1 year, after which Max and his Agathe may marry. The hermit leads a song of thanksgiving for divine mercy. Well, orchestra assembled on the stage, as is the Monteverdi Choir, in wedding costume. Well, bright 1930s French rural dresses for the ladies. The piece was set at the Opéra Comique in France, in rural France in the 1930s. Here comes John Elliott Gardner joining the Orchestre Révolutionnaire Romantique on stage here in the Albert Hall. He brings them to their feet. Before beginning Act 3 of Weber's opera Der Freischütz in Berlioz's French version. Thank you.
Thank you. métier si bonne. Il faut ouvrir ce coffre, l'on met ta couronne, car voici tes filles d'honneur. Bonjour, belles enfants, pour lui porter bonheur, ce n'est plus la beauté que l'amour environne. Acceptez ces bouquets, et chacun vous donne.
j'entre me plaît. Votre Altesse est trop bonne. Autant que la petite soumier au bois. Qu'un triomphe complet justifie en ce jour son choix. Et mon bienfait, prince, croyez qu'il le mérite. Dieu, si mon bras tremblait, je ne vois pas la fiancée. Daignez permettre, monseigneur, que sans elle l'épreuve ici soit commencée. L'émotion redouble au moment du bonheur. Volontiers, sans doute à Paris jour, le cœur battait aussi. À la fête, voici, instant que je redoute. Oh, toi qui dans ma main n'es plus la cathale, plongeante, ne me sois pas fatale. Jeune chasseur, sois prêt. Tiens, cet oiseau qui tombe, c'est la colonne blanche. Ah, soutiens-moi, mon Dieu.
Quand on casse mal le chasseur, tout le pavé, nous avons peur, tes sœurs. Thank you.
Max's punishment is to be banished for just 1 year, after which he may return home to marry his Agatha. And that's the end of this Proms premiere of Weber's opera Der Freischützin, the version Berlioz made for the work's first performance in Paris in 1841. Well, the three bridesmaids were Lucy Roberts, Katie Hill, Kate Simons-Joy from the Monteverdi Choir. The hermit was Luc Bertin Hugo, Prince Ottokar, Robert Davis, Zamio, Christian Pellissier, Kuno, Matthew Brook, Killian Samuel Evans, Annette, Virginie Pochon, Gaspard, the baddie, if you like, Guidon Sachs, Agatha Sophie Kartoiser, and Max Andrew Kennedy. With the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, leader Peter Hansen, conductor John Elliott Gardner. Here comes Luc Bertin Hugo, the hermit. And if we hadn't seen him before, Zamiel himself, Christian Pellissier. Well, John Eric Garner said Weber and Berlioz, both masters of dramatic pacing, and the French translation by Emilien Pacini, which Berlioz must have supervised, it worked really well. The language giving Kreischwitz that new sensuality and elegance. Somehow, this is sort of music which seems, you know, very similar to Beethoven's Fidelio, and appropriate on the penultimate night of the BBC Brahms when Beethoven 9 is so often being performed. Virginie Pochon, Annette coming onto the stage. Might be some boos. No, thunderous cheers. Gaspar. Oh, and a few boos. Guido Sachs, he's just folding his arms and giving it back to them. Larger than life figure. Well, John Elliott Gardner goes off to conduct Beethoven with the LSO and the Monteverdi Choir. We're doing Beethoven 9 at Beethoven Halle in Bonn, and then Bach motets, a motet tour with the Monteverdi Choir ending at St. John's Smith Square. That was for Sophie Cartoys of the Agathe, and here comes Andrew Kennedy, our anti-hero, if you like, Max. And John Elliott Gardner, slightly sedate way, it's been a long evening for him. Above all, great energy throughout. Seems incredible we've got there already. Tomorrow at 7:30 here in the Albert Hall. And of course, live on Radio 3, the last night of the BBC Proms 2011 beckons. BBC Symphony Orchestra and chorus, of course, as always, conducted this year by Edward Gardner. Lang Lang playing Liszt and Chopin. Susan Bullock singing Wagner and Richard Rodgers. And it'll be the usual let your hair down end of season party. But as the Monteverdi Choir take their particular bow, with a great yell from everyone here in the Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain back at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, tomorrow night, as Martin was saying, the last night of the Proms, and the celebrations open with a new piece by the master of the Queen's music, Sir Peter Maxwell Davis. Well, between now and the essay at 10:45, a Maxwell Davis piece from almost a couple of decades ago. Cross Lane Fair is one of his childhood memory pieces, the very young Maxwell Davis personified by lilting Northumbrian pipes and a pattering bodhran, the Irish drum. And he's carried on his father's back through the Salford Fair, enjoying the lights and the music of the roundabout, slightly but pleasurably scared by the ghost train, dismayed at the freak show with its five-legged sheep, probably determining to imitate the juggler when he gets home, but falls asleep on his father's shoulder before he gets there. I'm afraid we don't have time for the entire piece, so let's join it at The Bearded Lady and the Five-Legged Sheep. The composer himself conducts the BBC Philharmonic. the close of Cross Lane Fair by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, the composer himself there conducting the BBC Philharmonic. And his latest piece, Musica Benevolens, has its world premiere in tomorrow night's Last Night of the Proms. It's the opening piece, in fact, 7:30 for that, live from the Royal Albert Hall. And here on BBC Radio 3, and following on from the Max piece, there's Bartok's Miraculous Mandarin, the immolation scene from Wagner's Götterdämmerung with Susan Bullock as Brunhilde, and Lang Lang playing Liszt's first piano concerto. And that's only the first half of the concert. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 11:15. And now in the final programme in his series of essays about cinema of the 1940s, the writer and journalist Simon Heffer offers a fresh and personal interpretation of The Blue Lamp.
At the start of this long road through the British cinema of the 1940s, I sought to explain how films were used during the darkest hours of the Second World War to help bond society together. We were all in the same boat, with a common enemy, and war became a means of cohesion. By the end of the 1940s, reality had changed. In the voiceover that begins The Blue Lamp, filmed by Ealing Studios in the summer of 1949 and released in January 1950, an account is given of dislocation, decay and destruction. Newspaper headlines, real rather than manufactured, are splattered across the screen. They detail armed robberies, shootings and other crimes by predominantly young thugs who, we are told, lack the code of the professional criminal. We are further told that these are the products of households sundered by the very war that, a few years earlier, we thought was binding us together. Things have not turned out quite as we imagined.
To this man, until today, the crime wave was nothing but a newspaper headline. What stands between the ordinary public and this outbreak of crime? What protection has the man in the street against this armed threat to his life and property?
Realism is the hallmark of The Blue Lamp, even if today the film shows a society and a method of policing that seemed to be from another planet. The impression at the time, though, was that the film showed such a troubling aspect of society that it sent a shockwave through Britain. For this is the film now best remembered as the one in which P.C. George Dixon, played by Jack Warner, is shot outside a cinema in the Edgware Road by a young robber played by Dirk Bogarde. This was 2 years before the infamous murder of a policeman by Christopher Craig and, by the law of common purpose, the unfortunate Derek Bentley. There was no question but that the ordered society was breaking down and that a delinquency problem was taking a grip on Britain. Ealing was just a little ahead of the game in bringing home this depressing fact to the public. The film sets out its stall unequivocally in that opening voiceover. Youths who engaged in crime had normally stuck to petty larceny. Serious crime had been the province of an established underworld, all of whom knew the rules. Early in the film, when Tom Riley, played by Bogarde, takes his sidekick Spud to solicit the cooperation of an old-school gangster in fencing the proceeds of a jewel robbery they're about to commit, the gangster tells them to get lost. Plainly, they don't know the rules, as he instinctively understands, and we shall soon see. Where it might be thought this film truly defies belief is in the denouement, where the underworld helps the police to catch Riley. But that is precisely what both criminals and the police of that era have testified would happen, not least to allow the former to carry on operating with the minimum of interference from the latter. Yet there is a further and more disturbing message in this film. Doubtless youths like Riley and Spud, of whose family backgrounds we are shown nothing, went wrong because of the absence of a firm parental hand. We see the context of domestic violence in which Riley's girlfriend lives with her feckless parents, its unpleasantness sufficing to make even him attractive to her. However, what we also see is the lid being blasted off a society whose heavy-handed centralisation and state control have not been alleviated by the advent of peace in 1945, but had, if anything, become even more apparent. The hand of the state was visible in almost everything in 1949, including how much of certain foods one could eat, how much clothing one could buy, and what young men could do with their lives. Riley and Spud must be on the verge of being called up for national service. I'm not saying that Riley shoots P.C. Dixon because he wishes to make a protest against the intrusion of the state into the lives of individuals. He shoots him because he is an immature, vicious thug. However, the society that produced Riley is one in which the roles of individuals, such as that of nurturing, have been marginalised, and the state has taken upon itself the notion that it, at all times, knows best. The Blue Lamp needs to be seen with two of the great Ealing comedies that came just before it, Whiskey Galore and Passport to Pimlico. What links these apparently disparate films, other than their having come from the same studios within a few months of each other, is what they say about contemporary society, its overregulation, and the officiousness of government. A particularly sharp comparison can be made between Passport to Pimlico and The Blue Lamp. They are both set in a London of summer heat, bomb sites, spivs, and restlessness. They were both written by T.E.B. Clarke. They both throw up significant challenges to authority, challenges that are successfully seen off, but, one suspects, only temporarily in the case of The Blue Lamp. The main difference is that Passport to Pimlico, like Whiskey Galore, makes its points with humour, while The Blue Lamp is almost like a documentary. Clarke's script for The Blue Lamp retains the respectable working-class values of Passport to Pimlico, here embodied by the police and their families. There is none of the cynicism about the force that would come later in dramatisations of their work after Operation Countryman in the 1970s, which exposed extensive and chronic corruption from the top to the bottom of Scotland Yard. However, in other respects, the approach could not be more different. There is an earnestness to the film that simply highlights the struggle that authority was having with a new world created by the end of the war and the explosion of welfareism. Even a cuddly beat policeman like George Dixon, who seems to know everyone on his manor and to know, too, how to deal with them without becoming heavy-handed, would have to change his way of doing business, were he to live long enough to do so. Dixon's main focus in life outside the job is his begonias, and sharing with his sweet and mumsy wife memories of their son, who appears to have died in the war. We are never told this explicitly, but he serves as an unseen contrast with the ghastly Riley in matters of service, duty and sacrifice. The Dixons acquire a substitute son in the form of Dixon's colleague Andy Mitchell, straight out of training college, whom they take in as a lodger. Dixon dies halfway through the film, but Clarke imposes him on his script in the first 40 minutes or so in a way that succeeds in making him the dominant presence even after he has died. In doing so, we get the clearest exposition of those working-class values of decency, solidarity, honesty and community that stand at the polar opposite to Tom Riley and his sort. When a panicking, hysterical Riley pulls the trigger and shoots Dixon twice in the abdomen, the look of shock on Dixon's face is not just at the physical pain, but at the fact that the natural order of things has been so inverted that this could happen. This was the moment that shocked Britain too, despite the upsurge in violent crime that had occurred in the late 1940s. As the voiceover at the start of the film said, serious professional criminals had a code. Here was its most brutal violation. Dixon has been called to the scene of a robbery at a cinema box office. Looking like something out of the cheapest American B-movie, Riley has covered the bottom of his face with a handkerchief tied round his head and brandishes a Wild West pistol at the cashier. His accomplice, the apparently even more bovine Spud, bludgeons the doorman, though Spud, who has warned Riley not to take a gun with him, instantly realises the gravity of what happens when Dixon is shot in a way that Riley, for a moment, affects not to. In the film's most famous exchange, Dixon tells Riley, "Drop it, son, don't be a fool." Words echoed unconsciously at the end of the film when the police corner Riley at the White City dog track. Riley tells Dixon to back off or I'll drop you. Dixon doesn't imagine he's serious. Riley probably doesn't imagine he is either, but he pulls the trigger anyway. In this confrontation between anarchy and authority, there can be no winners. Justice comes at a price. Dixon dies later in hospital. Riley, we suspect, will end with a rope around his neck. It is ironic that Riley's capture is facilitated by the cooperation of the underworld. He tries to melt into the crowd at the White City dog track, but, alerted by the police, the management lock the doors so no one can get out. As criminals in the stands spot him darting about, they tell bookies, who use tic-tac to pass the message on. The police soon know where to find him. The combination of the forces of law and order with the forces of crime accentuates what Ealing must have hoped would be the message of the film, that people like Riley were beyond the pale and would be treated as such. The implication is that the overstepping of traditional boundaries would be a temporary phenomenon, and society, in all its other forms, would come together to ensure this was so. Unfortunately, what the film depicts is the beginning of a slippery slope. If the post-war settlement of the New Jerusalem is to be seen as the beginning of a classless society, in which deference had been brought to an end, then it needs to be seen as such with one important qualification. Deference is still demanded, but not to a class that imagines itself deserving of it by birth. It is now demanded by a bureaucracy, and one whose face is less appealing even than that of the old upper class. The last remnants of feudalism and of noblesse oblige have been swept away by the advent of welfarism. Individual duty has been replaced by the duty of the state. If there is a shortage of role models in society for people like Tom Riley, it will not purely be because his father may have been absent for 6 years of his childhood fighting for his country, or may have been killed in the war, or may have come home and then run off with another woman. It is because the traditional forces in society of setting an example and giving a lead have themselves been emasculated, their role supplanted by that of the state. A community, however feudal, no longer deals with the likes of Tom Riley before they go wrong. There are what we now call social workers, and the probation service, to do that instead. If you think back to Went the Day Well, which I discussed in the first of these talks, there is no longer, it seems, a class who, without any prompting by the state, knows it has a role to bring in everyone else along behind it. The only member of the upper classes we meet in the Blue Lamp exhibits the new decadence of her caste. She is stopped for careless driving and proceeds to patronise and insult the policeman who does so. It is not just the lower orders who no longer see the need to play by the rules, and for whom the traditional ties of one part of society to another appear to have been broken. Two violent acts seem to me to typify the beginning and the end of the political journey made by the British cinema in the 1940s. The self-sacrifice of the Lady of the Manor in Went the Day Well, running out of a room full of children with a hand grenade and blowing herself up, begins the journey to idealism. The shooting of George Dixon in the Blue Lamp aborts it. The destination, glimpsed occasionally in the distance before 1945, may no longer even exist. Whisky galore and Passport to Pimlico register this with typical British phlegm. Yet The Blue Lamp, unlike those two other films, finds nothing to joke about. Poor old Mrs. Dixon is widowed, left to face an old age without either husband or son, who both, in their different ways, died in the line of duty. P.C. Mitchell, the last person we see in the film, has played a vital part in the capture of Dixon's murderer. But one senses from his demeanour that this is not the job he thought he was coming into. His dissolution must stand for all societies. It is not, perhaps, too early to wheel out the cliché that, having won the war, Britain was busily engaged in the business of losing the peace. This would be a slow and, for many, a painless defeat, with no instant harsh reality, such as the arrival of the Nazis on the doorstep. Therefore, the British film industry had nothing to lose by portraying the truth about post-war Britain in a way it could not or dared not have done during the war, when the script read that we were all in it together. The films it made were, for the most part, well-acted, well-written, and highly entertaining. They remain, in many cases, unsurpassed by what came afterwards, not least because the rise of television in the 1950s ensured that most homemade entertainment looked down at heel, cheap, and formulaic. But the films of the 40s were beyond entertainment. They had a distinct political message. Those who worked at Ealing claimed there was a left-wing ethos at the studios, like that of a country that had put Attlee into Downing Street in 1945. Yet the ethos did not stop filmmakers noting the contrast of reality and adapting to reflect the disillusion too. After all, business is business. Sadly, what the film industry could not see at the end of the 40s, or would not believe, was that over the next decade, it, too, would fall victim to a seismic change.
That was the final programme in Simon Heffer's series of essays on British cinema of the 1940s. The essays were first broadcast last September, and the producer was Beattie Rubens. It's 11 o'clock, and in a couple of hours I'll be taking you through the night here on Radio 3 with a concert from last year's Chopin Festival in Warsaw. Schumann's Piano Concerto and Chopin's Second Piano Concerto played on pianos of their time. That's from 1 o'clock tonight. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. And now, World on 3 with Mary Ann Kennedy.
Some beautiful things lined up for you tonight from around the globe. Discs from Brazil, Cambodia, Egypt, Armenia and more. And as ever, we'll have some fabulous live music here in the studio. I'm Mary Ann Kennedy, and the World on Three guest tonight is a real pioneer from the Gambia, the first female kora player from a celebrated griot family. Lopa Katari will be finding out more about her later on. But let's hear straight off what makes Sona Jabarti so special.
So I'm here today with my full band, but I'm going to start off with a piece on the kora entitled Sunjata, which is a traditional piece from West Africa, which chronicles the history of the whole of the Mandinga Empire. And it's a very important piece in the repertoire, but also one of my favourites. Thank you.
Sona Jubarte playing in session for World on Three, one of a family of musicians, a cousin of the great kora player Tumani Jubarte, but showing there that she's a great performer in her own right. Now, the new Nordic movement has been something of a phenomenon over the past few years, the crossing of the waters between the music and musicians of Scandinavia and Britain and Ireland. And while this next trio don't strictly fit into the category, inasmuch as they're a trio of English lasses, the music does draw on traditions of Northern Europe as much as from home. Lady Maisery are Hannah James, Sophie Askew and Rowan Rennigan. They got together in their common notion of creating a new female vocal group, and they took their name from one of the characters to be found in the Child Ballads. Their new album is called Weave and Spin, and you might already have heard a track featured on Late Junction last month, but no worries if not. Enjoy this one. It's their take on the traditional Irish I Know My Love.
I know my love by his way of walking. I know my love by his way of talking. I know my love in his suit of blue. And if my love leaves me, what will I do? And still she cried, I love him the best. And a troubled mind knows no rest. And still she cried, bonny boys of you. And if my love leaves me, what will I do? If my love knew I could wash and wring, and if my love knew I could weave and spin, I'd make a jacket of the finest kind. But for want of money he's left me behind. And still she cried, I love him the best. And a troubled mind knows no rest. And still she cried, bonny boys of you. And if my love leaves me, what will I do? Every night he takes a strange girl upon his knee. Now don't you think that it vexes me? And still she cried, I love him the best. And a troubled mind knows no rest. And still she cried, bonny boys of you. And if my love leaves me, what will I do?
Del mar. lleva una blanca piedra y el agua sonreía.
That was the young flamenco singer Sandra Carrasco, who hails from Andalusia, guesting on the latest project from the Spanish singer and guitarist Javier Limón. It's a musical journey around the Mediterranean. Now, that's not necessarily a unique thing to do, but in each musician's journey, the reactions, experiences and resulting music surely are. What sets Javier's pilgrimage apart is that he's taken his journeyings and then used them to collaborate with female musicians from all around the Med, each acting as the voice of a particular place. They range from the very well-known, such as Portuguese fadista Marisa and Greek singer Eleftheria Arvanitaki, to relatively new voices that are introduced to us in this project, like Sandra Carrasco. Before that was another lead from the ladies, the English trio Lady Masary, and they count among their fans the Icelandic singer Bára Grimsdóttir that I played a few weeks ago on the show. They've also set about reviving the mouth music tradition of diddling, and it's inspired by music from Scandinavia, but in the knowledge that it was once a thriving tradition in England and still is in Scotland as well. You're listening to Marianne Kennedy here on World on Three, and it's another collaborative venture next. This is the brainchild of the leader of the Shetland supergroup Fiddler's Bid. Chris Stout has always had a great musical curiosity, working in a whole range of genres, jazz and electroacoustic music as much as the traditional music of his native Fair Isle. A few years ago now, he and a bunch of other Scots musicians had the chance of collaborating at Glasgow's Arches Arts Venue with a group of musicians from São Paulo in Brazil. A reciprocal visit was next, all done.